Matthew, Mark, and Luke, not John, because that's a very special gospel, but the three synoptic ones, as they're called, because they see the work of Jesus with one eye, synoptics, are all agreed that this business of the healing of the man with the withered hand was the climax of Christ's controversy with the Pharisees about the question of the Sabbath. You may remember that towards the end of the second chapter, which we studied last Lord's Day, there was this collision with the Pharisees about how the Sabbath was to be observed and how it was not to be observed. Jesus and his disciples had gone for a walk. Through the cornfields on the Sabbath, Jewish Saturday, and as they went, they plucked the ears of corn, which was permitted by the law, because there's a law, dear me, and the subject is light and darkness tonight, so I don't know if we have any emergency lights, have we, Harry? Have we any candles or something? Oh, well. Plucking the ears of corn, there's a law, you see, in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 25. It says, when you come into your neighbor's field and the corn is standing, you may, if you're feeling hungry, pluck the ears of corn with your hands, presumably not with your sickles, in case you want to go home and really have a field day, but you may pluck the ears of corn with your hands if you're feeling peckish. But seemingly, the suggestion is that the disciples started rubbing the corn in their hands and thereby used their hands as millstones. And that, of course, is work. And you can't work on the Sabbath day. And so they complained to him. And this whole controversy, you see, of this tension between Jesus and the leaders of the church over the Sabbath day came to a climax with the healing of the man with the withered hand. And so you get a wonderful variety of motifs running through this third chapter. Can you see a pattern here? First of all, there's the healing of the man with the withered hand, the start of chapter 3. And that, of course, spills over into the criticism of the Pharisees, who had not come to church to be blessed. They had come to criticize Christ. That, in turn, spills over into verse 7. Where you get Jesus Christ withdrawing rather strategically away from the Pharisees and that world of barren controversy. He withdraws from them and calls out the 12. Now that again, you see, is a strategic action. It's policy, it's strategy, it's campaign, it's a military campaign. It's a strategic thing. So he withdraws in verse 7. In verse 13, he goes up into the hills and he calls out the 12. This in turn merges into the Beelzebub controversy at verse 22. This in turn spills over to the unpardonable sin, verse 28. And the whole chapter finishes with Jesus Christ calling out a new family of brothers and sisters. Now, do you see what that chapter is about? It's about two things. First of all, it's about the interplay of light and darkness. Now, there's a word in the world of art for this. It's the word chiaroscuro, chiaroscuro. The interplay of shades in a drawing or a painting. If ever you're in London, Try to see some of the Leonardo da Vinci cartoon drawings, his cartoons. Most famous one, of course, is the one with the Virgin that they paid hundreds of thousands for. Just a tiny drawing in red chalk. And it's wonderful, you see, how he can, with nothing but a little piece of red chalk, bring out and suggest all the shades of light and dark in a scene. Now, the artist's word for that is chiaroscuro, interplay of light and dark. I heard it referred to yesterday morning, not in connection with the world of art, but in connection with the world of music. Yesterday morning's broadcast of building a library, and it was building a library of Chopin. Now, I don't like Chopin, but I don't. Tinkly pianos. I don't like tinkly pianos. I like solid music, orchestras and choirs, big stuff. But it was a study, it was a broadcast on building up a library on the Chopin etudes, the studies. Now, Chopin's studies for the piano are very intimate works, and they really express the terrible unhappiness of his life. You know, he had a miserable personal life. It wasn't helped, really, by his relationship with that dreadful woman, Georges Sand, who just about destroyed him, and really did destroy him if tuberculosis hadn't got the better of him at the end. She almost certainly would have destroyed him. A terrible woman. And the reviewer of the record spoke about how light and shade, light and darkness come out in the piano playing. And it was illustrated. An interplay of light and darkness. Now, even if you don't know about the world of art or about the world of music, imagine yourself lying on a grassy lawn on a bright summer's day, and there are clouds in the sky and there's a bit of wind. And even if you close your eyes, you can feel light and dark flashing past you. Now, this whole chapter, you see, is a pattern of light and darkness. And by light, I mean where Jesus is and what Jesus is doing and what Jesus is saying. Light. And you get these flashes of light through the chapter. The healing of the man with the withered hand. The calling out of the 12. New brothers and sisters and mothers for Jesus at the end of the chapter. Sudden flashes of light. And over against the light, you find the darkness reacting against it. People who really are against Jesus. All the critics. People who come to church. Not to be blessed, but to sit and criticize. The interplay. The chiaroscuro of light and darkness. And one of the things that Christians need to learn is this. Because, of course, there is an interplay of light and darkness in every Christian life. Where you get the light, you'll get the darkness. And where you get the darkness, you get the light. And they're against each other. It's not just interplay, it's interaction. And it's not just interaction, it's opposition. Because spiritual light is opposed to spiritual darkness. You can't marry them. You can't put them into the same bed. They're against each other. And one of the first things that Christians need to learn about this interaction in today's Christian world, in our Christian life today, is that the light and the darkness are not equal. It's not 50% light against 50% darkness. If you want that kind of religion, you steer clear of Christianity, because that's not the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In fact, there is a religion in the world which preaches that there is ceaseless war between light and darkness, between day and night. It's a Persian religion, and it's called Zoroastrianism. And it's a hopeless religion, because it's about the seesaw between light and darkness. 50% light fighting against 50% darkness, absolutely hopeless, just an endless struggle, and you get absolutely nowhere. That's not a gospel, that's a message of despair. But the great thing about the gospel of Jesus Christ is that the victory lies with the light. The light triumphs. The battle is with the light and not with the darkness. And we need to convince ourselves of this. Now, it's not just a case of whistling in the dark and hoping that this is going to be so. This is so. The light is greater than the darkness. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot put the light out. Light is greater than darkness. Just as the second Adam is greater than the first Adam, because the second Adam is Christ, and he made the first Adam. The second Adam made the first Adam. Light and darkness. And the light greater than the darkness. The second thing you see in this chapter is this. Now, this is more subtle. Not just the interplay of light and darkness, but light with darkness at its heart and darkness with light at its heart. Now that's very, very subtle. And in fact, it's one of the key themes of Scripture, that where you get the light, where you get Christ acting and speaking and healing and saving, you'll get a germ of darkness somewhere. Judas Iscariot was one of the 12. He wasn't an outsider. If he was a foreigner or an alien to the group, you might have understood why he did the thing that he did. But Judas Iscariot was one of the 12. You get germs of darkness where the light is living and where the light is acting. That's why you get hypocrites in the Christian church. In fact, the worst hypocrites are found in the Christian church. That's why Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes, in chapter 3 and verse 16, that it was a cause of great sadness to his heart that in the place of righteousness you could find wickedness. And in the place of justice, you could find wickedness. Pools of light where Jesus is acting and living and speaking and saving. And always at the heart, a germ of darkness at the heart of the light. Can you understand that? My friend, Joseph Stalin trained for the priesthood. And he murdered 20 million Russians. He was going to be a priest. And don't you know that the leaders of the Communist Party in Hungary today were all involved in Christian youth work in Hungary before 1940? Miklos, our good brother, told me the story of how a policeman came to a Christian with his notebook. He said, "I want you to tell me the names of all the men who were involved in the revival in 1939, 1940, just before the war. There was a great work in Hungary amongst young people, particularly a sort of a YMCA kind of thing. There were youth groups all over the country turning to Christ, led by able men. And the policeman said to the Christian, I want the names of all the men who were involved with these youth groups before the war. And so the Christian said, of course. And he started rattling off the names. The policeman said, stop. He was reading the names of all the leaders in the Communist Party. You see, sin began in heaven. Did you know that? It's one of the most shattering things that the Bible tells us about sin. That it didn't start down here where you might have expected it to start. It started in heaven. It started in the holiest place of all. Sin started under the very shadow of God's throne. That's why the worst sins are always religious sins. The worst sins are not drink and adultery and all these rather obvious things. The worst sins are the spiritual sins in people's hearts, jealousy and pride and envy and hatred and cattiness. The worst sins. And they are the worst sins simply because sin began in a spiritual place. So can you see what's going on in this chapter? It's light against darkness. It's Jesus and his world, his words, his actions, his salvation, his touch, his healing, his help, his power. It's all that over against the world of darkness represented by the Pharisees and the leaders of the church. And then as well as that, it's light with darkness at its heart, churchy people, darkness, and it's darkness with light. Chapter 3 and verse 1. He entered the synagogue. The chapter starts and ends with light. Isn't that marvelous? He entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand, and they watched him. Can you see the new world creeping in here? And they watched him to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. Luke tells us in his gospel that it was the man's right hand that was withered. And there is an obscure book, not in our Bible, called the Apocryphal Gospel to the Hebrews. And it tells us that the man was a stonemason. Now, of what use is a stonemason whose right hand is withered? You see, the thing that is in question here in the man's life is his utter uselessness as a man. In a sense, he's just as much a reject as a leper. He's just as much an outcast as if he was a leper, because the man is helpless and useless because of one limb that is wrong. Have you never noticed, my friend, what an imperious thing pain can be? I had a sore head and it ruined my day. One sore head and it ruins a day. You have a tiny arthritic pain in a joint, as I have sometimes in that just the one finger. Oh, but it doesn't go further than that. But it's a needly pain, you know. It's a rheumaticy, nagging pain. It can spoil a whole symphony concert just by needling, nagging, nagging. Even if you have a bad tooth, it can spoil hours of pleasure because of the insistence of physical pain. Now here's a man with one hand gone wrong, and his whole body and his whole life were useless because of it. Do you know what that man needed most of all? Oh, of course he needed his hand put right. Do you know what he needed most of all? And the longer I live, the more I believe that sinners need to know this, that God accepts us in Jesus Christ. He accepts you, warts and all, as Cromwell said. Warts and all, your ugly bits as well. That's why some of the evangelists are quite right when they say, come just as you are. Don't tidy up your life and then come. Don't sort out the withered hand problem and then come. You come with your withered hand. That's why Jesus said to the man in the church, hold up your hand. And it was the man's shame. I mean, this is the thing that spoiled him. This is the thing that wrecked his life. This is the thing that made him a cripple. Now, a very useless cripple into the bargain. I tell you, Christians, it would be a major psychological salvation if you could believe how totally accepted you are in Jesus Christ. And even when you come to Jesus Christ with all your warts, he won't criticize you. He won't look down his nose. He's not patronizing. He's not superior about the failings and the sins of other people. He will accept you just as you are. He swallows you up whole, warts and all. You see, I'm really trying to say that you should come to Jesus with your withered hand. If there is something in your life that is paralyzing you and crippling you, speaking on a psychological level now, then you should come to Jesus Christ with it. You can hardly come without it, can you? Where are you going to put your withered hand? In a drawer at home, and then come to Jesus Christ. Bring your withered hand to Jesus Christ. Bring to Jesus Christ the thing that's paralyzing you and making you useless as a Christian. This is God's day. This is God's house. And we're God's people. This is a day of healing. This is a special day in the eyes of God. I know that you can be healed on other days of the week. You can be healed on Mondays and Thursdays, any other day of the week. But because Jesus Christ rose on this day from the dead, this is a special day, and this is a hospital here, as we were saying in the opening prayer. This is a hospital. This is where people are made whole. And you can only be made whole if you come to Jesus Christ bringing the thing that cripples your life. Unless, of course, you don't want to be healed. What a pool of light at the start of the chapter. verse 20. And the crowd came together again, here comes the darkness, so that they could not even eat. And when his friends heard it, they went out to seize him, for he said, he's beside himself, the man's crazy. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem, the Gestapo, you see, these are the big guns now. None of your backwoods small fry ministers now. Here come the big fellows. Came down from Jerusalem and they said, he is possessed by Beelzebul, the Lord of the devils, the Lord of the midden, and by the prince of demons, he casts out demons. That's the darkness. You see, if they'd really read their Bibles, they would have known that there is a special curse in the Old Testament, and it's pronounced by God upon people who call good evil and evil good. You see, it's one thing to say that you don't agree with Jesus. The world is full of people who don't agree with Jesus. They don't agree with Jesus on marriage. They don't agree with Christ's teaching on sexual morality, which is chastity. That's all he offers anybody. Doesn't matter what their sexual tastes are, that's all that Jesus Christ offers men and women today, is a life of chastity. You are either single and chaste, or you're married and chaste. There's nothing else. Absolutely nothing else. Lots of people disagree with Jesus, but it's one thing to say that you disagree with Jesus, and it's another thing to say that Jesus Christ is the servant of Beelzebul. God says in Isaiah chapter 5, woe unto those who take the bitter and call it sweet, and who take the sweet and call it bitter. It's worth reading. Isaiah chapter 5. What words? The Bible, I'm a child. Every time I come to it, I feel like a baby drinking in mother's milk. I feel so ignorant of the Bible. Do you ever feel like that? You read a page and you say, oh Lord, I haven't started. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 18. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes. It's their business. It's their trade. Verse 20. Now you see, here's the darkness barging into the light. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. That's the unpardonable sin, you know. People say that rejecting Jesus Christ is the unpardonable sin, and so it is. Of course, if you reject Jesus Christ, there's no hope for you. There's no hope for anyone who rejects Jesus Christ finally and irrevocably. But the unpardonable sin is worse than that. It's a whole attitude of life against the spiritual world. Verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. That's the unpardonable sin. Who put darkness for light and light for darkness, saying that Jesus really belongs to the devil. Who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And it really is very solemn that the next verse comes here. In the same class, you see. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and their own importance and their own righteousness and shrewd in their own sight. And it's interesting that the next verse comes here in the permissive society. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine, and valiant men in mixing strong drink, all in the one class, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of the right. Do you know what Jesus learned from this Beelzebub thing? He learned what lots of ministers have to learn, and what lots of ordinary lay Christians have to learn, that very often the work of God goes on in spite of church people and not because of it. Not because of them. Very often the work of Christ in Scotland has gone on in spite of presbyteries rather than because of them. And today, it's almost true, not universally, thank God, and increasingly so, not universally, that the work of Christ goes on in Scotland in spite of many church people. Darkness against light, and the light was even greater than they thought, you see. When Jesus said, how can a kingdom that is divided against itself stand? Do you not see what he's saying? That the devil's kingdom is divided against itself. That's what he's saying. That there is chaos in hell. That hell is a shambles. And that if you, in your worst moments as a Christian, were to look for a fraction of a second into the belly of hell, you would see such bedlam and such chaos as would immediately lift up your heart, and you would go on your way singing and rejoicing as a Christian. But however much the kingdom of evil gets you down as a Christian, it is a kingdom that is divided against itself. There is chaos in hell. Now there's light for you. The unpardonable sin. Well, it's to take light and call it darkness. And it's to take darkness and call it light. Is that the end of the story? Not really. Because the chapter ends with light. You see, the last word is with the light. What does Jesus do? He does two things. In the next chapter, if you know the next chapter, he starts speaking about the hiddenness of God's kingdom. So he turns away from the church. He turns away from the establishment and the big guns. He doesn't lean on them anymore. And he starts speaking about the hiddenness of God's kingdom in the parables of the kingdom, which are all about hidden things. The seed is hidden. The coin was lost. The pearl hadn't been found. The treasure was buried in a field. First of all, he does two things. First of all, he starts speaking about the underground kingdom of God. And then he does the second thing. He starts speaking about, it ends with light, you see. A new genealogy. A crowd was sitting about him. They said to him, Your mother and your brothers are outside asking for you. They maybe thought they were important because of Jesus, you see. Maybe Mary was trying to get importance for herself because of Jesus. You know, just as some mothers revel on the importance of their family. You know, they are somebody because of their families. They're not somebody's because of themselves. They're somebody's because of their families. And they bask, you see, in the sunshine of their families, ambition and all that sort of thing. And Jesus wipes all that out and he says, "Who are my brother and my mother and my brothers? Here are my mother and my brothers." It has nothing to do with blood, natural ties. "Whoever does the will of God," what a family, "is my brother and my sister and my mother." A new family, a new creation, a new community. In closing, turn up Hebrews chapter 2. Here's light for you. Chapter 2 and verse 10. Here's Christ and his family. It's an overworked word, but I will use it. Super. Here is a super picture of Jesus Christ standing in heaven on the last day, and he's surrounded by all his bairns, a vast family, brothers and sisters and mothers and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And he looks up into his Father's face and says, "Well, God, here I am. Here's the family you gave me." Absolutely wonderful. Hebrews 2 and 10. "For it was fitting that he," that's God, "for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory." Watch all the words that have to do with family here. "Bringing sons to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation," that's Christ, "perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies," that's God, "he who separates them is God, and those who are sanctified have all one origin. That is why Christ is not ashamed to call them brothers." Here's the new family. "Saying," and this is a quotation from the 22nd Psalm. I wish there were time. You know, it's the Psalm that Jesus died quoting. Psalm 22. It's the Psalm that starts, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And Jesus died quoting it. And the first half of the Psalm is crucifixion Psalm. The second half of the Psalm is resurrection Psalm. And this is from the resurrection bit. Jesus, risen from the dead, looking at his family, and he says, "I will proclaim thy name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation I will praise thee." And again, this is a quotation from Isaiah, "I will put my trust in him." And again, "Here he is, look, here am I. And the children God has given me." What a blaze of light. But where do you stand in this business of light against darkness? You can't belong to both worlds. You're either for the one and against the other, or you're for the other and against the one. Where do you stand? It's maybe all summed up in one of the posters that the Jesus movement used to stick up all around America, and they've been over here too, although I wish Scots Christians would think up Scottish Christian posters rather than force us to use all that American stuff. You know that one which goes, "Join God's forever family." And that's the Christian church. The brothers, the sisters, the mothers, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren of Jesus Christ. "Who are my mother and my brothers?" says Jesus. The people who are in the new community, the new creation, the church of Jesus Christ. So, join God's forever family. Grow in and grow up. Amen. May God bless the preaching of his word.